this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, The Startup Whisperer, How This MapQuest Co-Founder is Adamant on Changing the Triangle's Startup Scene. And that headline with a large picture of the Startup Whisperer is on the front page, but then the cover story is inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline, Acceleration Mode, Chris Heavely's Startup Fever. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. It started with a giant, big IBM thing in the 1980s, the kind of machine that printed out numbered lines with rhythmic screeches. Chris Heavely, then a geography undergraduate at Westchester University in Pennsylvania, was in a computer mapping class, a side elective, but the bulky machine inspired a pivot. He kept coding, putting himself into a pretty exclusive group, geography majors with computer skills, skills that enabled machines to do something previously done by AAA employees with highlighters, map routes. In the 80s, when he graduated with a master's degree from the University of South Carolina, there were really two options for people with his expertise, Heavely says, big business or government. But Heavely took the 1% road and decided to take his mapping technology to the consumer. Auto clubs were producing 15 million of what AAA branded as triptychs per year. Travelers would stop by their local AAA office and pick up a map, manually highlighted, with directions from city to city. We said, let's build a better version of that, Heavely recalls. Soon after, his code was adopted for the internet to create the MapQuest web service for a company called Geosystems Global Corporation. That company changed its name to MapQuest in 1999, and later that year it was sold to AOL in a $1.1 billion stock deal. Despite MapQuest's big exit, Heavely, 55, remained shy about his personal gain from the deal. The part I find frustrating is that most people use the financial return as a marker of someone's true success, he says, adding the culture of entrepreneurship carries more value to a community. Today, he's driving that concept home at what he calls Durham's only equity accelerator, the Startup Factory, TSF. But in pushing for triangle entrepreneurship, that guy with the crazy hair and the silly clothes, as he imagines he's called, is fighting an uphill battle. The triangle's startup output pales in comparison to some other hubs, while ShareFile, Appia, Automated Insights, Digital Smiths, Eye Contact, and Strike Iron all stand out as healthy examples of triangle exits. There's still no billion-dollar blockbuster, no WhatsApp headlines forcing investors from across the U.S. to pay attention. But Heavely believes in traction and creating an energetic ecosystem for people with fresh ideas. Barry Glick, who led MapQuest as CEO for 8 years prior to its sale to AOL, says Heavely was never the typical tech guy. He was not the technology guy or girl that sits in the back and does their thing with the headphones, he says. He was definitely more social and into networking and people skills. That was always his persona. Heavely's involved in more than just TSF, hosting job fairs, organizing festivals. He's even written a book, or he's writing a book. And a surprise to some of his entrepreneurs, the hockey fan still hits the ice every Sunday, chasing after 20-year-olds for the puck. People see my extroverted personality, that I'm involved in a lot of things. What they don't know is I'm very process-driven, he says. Inside the hub. It's quiet in Heavely's glass office, a space he shares with TSF co-founder Dave Neal. That's because the desks on the other side of the glass are unoccupied, dormant until the next class is announced. For 6 months out of the year, it's a cyclone of activity, with the 9:07 stand-up meeting. No one is late for a 9:07 meeting, and mentors moving in and out, sharing wisdom with the entrepreneurs clustered around the tables. Heavely's group was the first tenant in American Underground, deep in the basement of what used to be a tobacco warehouse. He remembers those early conversations with the Goodmans, the founders of Capital Broadcasting Company, who made crafting the space a personal mission. They didn't seem to mind that Heavely, a transplant with only 3 years in North Carolina, wanted to be the guy to create an entrepreneurship community within those bricks. They had a lot in common, Where most people saw destitute old warehouses, the Goodman saw opportunity. Where many saw businesses closing in North Carolina, Heavely saw the growth of an entrepreneurship community. We said if you want this to be a destination of startups and founders, you have to make sure there are a lot of entrepreneurs here, Heavely says. And he's delivered. In the past 3 years, 31 companies have mushroomed behind the glass. A prediction comes true. In the same room that used to be a complete crap hole, in quotes, stacked with decades of junk, those companies have cranked out products and business plans. In the fall of 2009, Heavely, who had spent the past decade, quote, being that guy that investors parachute into a company as some C-level executive, unquote, was the chief operating officer of Ultimus, a $20 million revenue company. He had cash as the founder of the digital division that would be MapQuest. He had experience, an ex-president of Rand McNally. And he had something he wanted to change. A 5-year stint with the venture capital arm of a mapping company left him with disdain for the traditional investment model. He'd moved to Chapel Hill, tired of the winter weather in Chicago, and was looking for opportunities. I was starting to read about these accelerator programs, he says. Heavily admits he hated being a pure venture capitalist, but was intrigued by the idea of investors mentoring and not just funneling cash towards a business. But he knew he couldn't do it without a community. I started running around town just meeting everyone I could, he says, and that's how he met Neil, his TSF co-founder. Finding the right structure. Neil had been thinking about doing something similar for more than a decade, and Heavely came along at the right time. After seeing what he did with Launchbox, I called him up and said, hey, are you still interested in that idea? Neil says. Neil recalls Heavely first talking about a TSF-like concept at their first networking lunch at a Chinese restaurant. He's sort of what I've always looked for, he says, adding that he had been looking for someone who is the opposite of me. Neil proved to be a valuable ally, a Triangle local, and just the guy to introduce Heavely to the community. TSF is a startup for startups, Heavely says, with 2 3-month sessions a year, currently readying for its 7th group. Companies, in addition to mentorship, receive an equity infusion of $50,000. Of the 31 companies, 28 are technically alive, with about 24 being worked on full-time. Not all stay in North Carolina. Sarah Capra, co-founder of Orate, which is prepping to move back to Washington, D.C., says that no matter where entrepreneurs end up, they gain more than funding from Heavely's team. Along with credibility, Heavely gives confidence. At the end of the day, he says, it's your company, Capra says. You know way more than anyone else. You need to take in what they say and take it on board, but you need to do what you feel is right for your company. But Heavely's startup ties to the Tar Heel State eclipses the ones that seek out-of-state refuge, landing in North Carolina. In one of the Triangle networking events attended by Heavely, John Austin, founder of NC Idea, funded Groundwork Labs, heard that Heavely was, quote, a well-connected guy that I might want to know, unquote. He went on to share an office with Heavely, running the now-defunct Joystick Labs, and calls TSF one of the components of a vibrant startup ecosystem. Anil Chawla, then an employee at IBM, met with Heavely to pitch him on an idea that he thought could really make it, a company that was like Priceline, but lets customers haggle for services at all local businesses. He remembers Heavely, a man whose background preceded him. I was in awe, shooting him down. He said you would need an army of salespeople to get to every little small business and convince them to try that out, Chawla says. But a few ideas later, Chawla's idea for Archive Social got him an acceptance to Heavely's accelerator, where he got to experience TSF in action. Today, he has about 10 employees at an American Underground office on Main Street. I think he has a true passion for startups and entrepreneurship, he says, referring to Neil as the methodical systems guy. Chris is your enthusiast. He's like your cheerleader. You can tell he really thrives being around entrepreneurs, startups, ideas, and playing some role. Initially, Heavely teamed up with another accelerator out of Washington, D.C., Launchbox Digital, borrowing from its playbook and creating a three-month accelerator session. Of the seven initial companies, two survived, Kiona Health and Spring Metrics. Wonderful odds for a startup, he says. Joan Seaford Rose, president of CED, sees Heavely and TSF as a big part of the Triangle's entrepreneurship future. His own experience as a successful entrepreneur gives him a lot of credibility, she says. And the Triangle can use all the cheerleaders it can get. Through Heavely's accelerator efforts, entrepreneurs figured out that there was a community that was eager to get something like this started, she says. The yield. Neither Heavely nor Neil rely on returns to put food on the table. Let's just say that I have a pretty compartmentalized view of my finances in that all of the success I have is parked to the side and, in my view, untouchable, he says. He shies from talking specifics, refuses to give any details about his bank account or personal wealth, but he did sell a $525,000 home in Chapel Hill last year in favor of his downsized Durham apartment. Heavely's a thrifty guy, even after the exit, driving his deceased father's Buick LeSabre, because it was free. It's that no-frills lifestyle that helps ensure his future is secure, with or without the returns from the personal investments he's made in TSF. The financial security does make it easier to be a good startup parent. Heavely says that, for better or worse, he's not anyone's boss or dad. A typical TSF stake is 7.5%. In return, startups get $50,000. Heavely says the money and the stake are not enough to be a decision maker. You can't put your foot down, he says, adding that he refuses to lose sleep no matter what his entrepreneurs do, which can mean taking a back seat and stifling his own objections. We're in the advice business, he says. This isn't Shark Tank. And along with this article, there's a They Said It section. The first quote is from Joan Seaford Rose, president of CED. He certainly is spending his time and dedicating his life to building a great startup culture and to supporting people ready to take that leap. From Barry Glick, former CEO of MapQuest, he was not the technology guy or girl that sits in the back and does their thing with the headphones. Sarah Capra, co-founder of Orate. As a result of Heavely and Neil working with us, just getting into TSF, it just gives us a little more credibility. And finally, Dave Neal, co-founder of the Startup Factory. I had actually looked at building something like this about 15 years ago and decided not to do it. Then, of course, I knew what Chris did with Launchbox Digital back in the fall of 2010. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Raleigh clothing startup to swim with sharks. Frill Clothing, a Raleigh startup that sells clothing gear to bridesmaids and sorority recruitment, will appear on ABC's Shark Tank. The business was launched by NC State University graduate Sharon Bowie and Appalachian State University graduate Kate Stedman while they were still students. While Frill Clothing, quote, is primarily targeted to sorority women who are looking to purchase affordable yet stylish outfits for recruitment, unquote, it is expanding into jewelry, accessories, and home decor, according to a release. The show airs March 6 at 8 p.m. on ABC. Ken Moak, I'm looking for opportunities. Biz caught up with Ken Moak at this week's CED Life Sciences Conference in Raleigh. I'm really excited by the energy that's coming into the area in terms of startups, he says. Moak, until recently, was the CEO of Durham-based Chimeric, but a media firestorm hit last year when Chimeric initially denied compassionate use access of an investigational antiviral drug to an 8-year-old in Virginia. It sparked a social media campaign that reportedly meant death threats for Moak. Moak won't talk about any of that. He won't talk about why he left, but he does hint at what's ahead. I'm looking for opportunities, he says. He's been talking to investors, biotechs, he's even looking out of state, and he says he's excited about what's ahead. Money madness. Okafor is worth $2.6 million to Duke. Freshman basketball player Jahlil Okafor is worth $2.6 million to Duke University. According to NerdWallet's number-crunching exercise that projects what players would be worth if they were paid. The report, which analyzes the Associated Press's top 25 teams as of March 2nd, is based on a revenue-sharing model similar to one used by the NBA, where players earn 50% of league revenue. NerdWallet applied that model to the revenues each university received in 2013 to 2014, which are publicly available figures from the U.S. Department of Education, and divided that by the players on the roster. The average value of a player at a top 25 school is $487,617, just $19,719 less than the average NBA player. A horseshoe for good luck. Chatham's Grochi wins Mustache Dash. Chatham County Extension Director Sam Grochi took the top prize for best horseshoe-style mustache in the National Cattlemen's Beef Association Mustache Dash competition. Winners were based on Facebook voting and announced at the association's annual convention in February. A horseshoe-styled mustache is defined as a full mustache with vertical extensions from the corners of the lips down to the jawline and resembling an upside-down horseshoe. The National Cattlemen's Beef Association is the national trade association representing U.S. cattle producers with more than 28,000 individual members and 64 state affiliate, breed, and industry organization members. And in the You Said It section, we have a quote from, or it's concerning, on the question of whether the old Greyhound bus depot should be demolished. It's hard to form an opinion when this many unknowns exist. Demolishing the structure seems like missing a huge opportunity, but if an alternative plan that would potentially bring a greater economic impact to the area exists and involves clearing the land, I'd like to hear about it. That's from Roy Blumenfeld. And on the upcoming auction of Woodlake Country Club, if I'm ever fortunate enough to buy a golf course in my life, I think it would be McCandless. The place would be a great night golf course. And that's from Randy Goines. And finally, in a section called The Hype, Triangle Communities make recent national headlines. Number one, Raleigh-Cary is best large metro in North Carolina. Number 56 nationwide for aging from the Milken Institute. Number one, Durham-Chapel Hill is best small metro in North Carolina. Number 41 nationwide for aging, also Milken Institute. Number 25, Raleigh's rank among U.S. cities for women in technology, from Smart Asset. And number 26, Raleigh's rank on nationwide Fit Cities Index, from Better Doctor. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. And first, we have Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. The first headline, Ripe for Development, Downtown Raleigh Bus Depot to be raised, Corner A&P to be preserved. The owners of two prominent properties in downtown Raleigh are at a crossroads regarding the fate of two blocks of buildings that some say are historic and should be preserved, but that some others say are not. Demolition permits have already been issued for five warehouse buildings at 1201 South Blunt Street that date back to the 1930s that Greyhound Bus Lines and its predecessor companies used for many years as a garage and service center. The property had been listed for sale at $1.45 million. Sources say that the nonprofit group Passage Home had been negotiating to buy the property for historic preservation and redevelopment. Raleigh architect Will Alfin, a consultant with Passage Home, says the group was envisioning spaces for artists, designers, and inventors, or a hub for makers that would provide jobs and skills training. But the Greyhound property also has some environmental issues due to oil leaks and underground storage tanks that must be addressed, and company officials have stated that they are ready to tear down the buildings to begin cleanup in hopes of finding a market-rate buyer for the site. Across town, a joint venture partnership has acquired the retail and office buildings at the corner of Hillsborough and West Streets with plans to preserve the former A&P grocery building on the site and redevelop the rest of the block with a mix that could include a hotel. The new owner of the site is a joint venture partnership of York Properties and Davidson & Jones Corporation of Raleigh and Shiner Capital Partners of Chicago, all of which have extensive real estate development experience in the Triangle. The group collectively paid $1.4 million for three of the seven parcels within the city block and have assumed control of a long-term land lease agreement on the other four parcels. The one-acre property was previously owned by a hotel developer that planned to build two new hotels on behalf of Aloft and Hampton Inn. The hotel projects, however, never came to fruition. And under a section called Economic Development, North Carolina ranks fourth in Governor's Cup. North Carolina improved its ranking to number four in Site Selection magazine's Governor's Cup competition for the state's most active in corporate recruitment and expansion in 2014. North Carolina trailed Texas, Ohio, and Illinois in the ranking, with 313 projects announced in 2014, which was up from 223 facility projects in 2013 when the state ranked number seven in the country. North Carolina also ranked in sixth place for the number of projects per capita, breaking into the top 10 for the first time. Kingsdown to open 500 branded mattress stores in China. Luxury mattress manufacturer Kingsdown Incorporated has announced the opening of its first Kingsdown-branded retail store in China after reaching a licensing agreement with a Chinese bedding retailer to open 500 Kingsdown stores in China over the next 5 years. The Mebane-based mattress manufacturer has signed a leasing agreement with Hong Kong bedding retailer Roth Bedding Technology International Limited, which is expected to open 65 stores in the first year of the program. And finally, under a section called Buy and Sell, new apartments to replace Six Forks Road complex. The Charlotte owners of a 1960s-era rental complex on Six Forks Road near Anderson Drive are going to start demolition now that tenants vacated at the end of February, as the group makes plans to build a new four-story apartment building with 182 new modern apartment units. White Point Partners acquired half of the five-acre site at 200 East Six Forks Road in December for $2.4 million. It is expected to close on the acquisition of the other half once the project has Raleigh planning approval. It is currently in site plan review. Bankrupt Woodlake Country Club near Pinehurst up for auction. A bankruptcy court judge has ordered the auction of the Woodlake Country Club in Vass near Pinehurst, a club with two 18-hole golf courses designed by golf design legends Ellis Maples and Arnold Palmer, and a 1,200-acre private man-made lake. The tax value for the courses, clubhouse, and lake is about $14 million, according to Moore County records, but bids are expected to start around $2.5 million, says Durham attorney Richard Hudson II, the court-appointed restructuring officer. The auction is set for March 26. And now we turn to the reporter page of Lauren Onosorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. Her first headline, Lilly CEO, Pharma Must Adapt. Big Pharma needs to change its strategy. That's the take of John Lechleiter, Chairman, President, and CEO, Eli Lilly and Company, speaking March 3 in the Raleigh Convention Center at the CED Life Sciences Conference. The biggest problem in biopharmaceutical R&D productivity today is that nearly two-thirds of the Phase 2 products fail to move on to Phase 3, he says, adding that failure is usually due to a lack of efficacy, not safety concerns. The problem, he adds, isn't about the number of molecules, it's about the basic understanding of disease. Partnering on molecules is good, he says. While drug hunting remains a vital activity, I think we need to advance, like our ancestors did, from hunting to farming, cultivating the knowledge of disease. He says competition can advance innovation for the industry and professionals working in North Carolina. It's no wonder that this state is in the top tier of states in life sciences, he says, adding that his home state of Indiana, too, is in the mix. The cost of drug development has increased from $320 million in the mid-1980s to well over $1 billion. One consequence of these pressures is the consolidation that has occurred in our industry, he says. At Lilly, we have resisted this approach. We've remained Lilly. The trend has reduced the number of large entities capable of taking on biopharmaceutical research and development on a global scale, and venture capital is decreasing. There's less money overall coming into the early-stage drug industry, he says. Universities are facing increased competition for research grants as applications have doubled and awards have remained flat. But rising populations and scientific breakthroughs are creating new opportunities regardless. He points to breakthroughs in cardiac care. Project focus companies, where pharma companies partner with venture capital firms to back specific projects, are one way to tackle the challenges, as are cross-company collaborative consortiums and universities, something particularly relevant to the Triangle, with UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University both researching compounds. Academia, he notes, wants to be a bigger part of the process, and that could mean licensure deals and new business opportunities. He predicts collaboration to happen earlier and earlier in the development process, and that, he says, means startup acquisitions. Town of Wilson gets broadband blessing from FCC. The town of Wilson could soon head a fiber empire. A move by the Federal Communications Commission could have the gigabit town expanding its high-speed broadband into other North Carolina communities. The FCC voted on February 26 to allow communities with municipal broadband, such as Wilson and Chattanooga, Tennessee, to spread their services outside town limits. Gregory Kwan of the Wireline Competition Bureau, speaking on behalf of the town of Wilson, said the town received numerous requests to expand into other communities, but its broadband efforts had been stifled by North Carolina legislation. FCC Commissioner Minion Clyburn says current regulations have some stuck in a digital desert and that towns like Wilson should not be denied the ability to respond to the infrastructure needs of their communities, particularly when the private sector has opted not to do so. Some communities literally beg private companies to bring broadband. Sadly, opportunities are being closed far too often, leaving citizens without broadband and leaders with few meaningful ways to address their needs, she says. Fellow Commissioner Jessica Rosen-Worcell called broadband a platform for opportunity. High-speed service is now necessary to attract and sustain businesses, expand civic services, and secure a viable future. Without it, no community has a fair shot in the digital age. Wilson did something that was fundamentally American, she says, in offering municipal broadband that supports gigabit speed. So today, we tear down barriers that prevent them from expanding their broadband service and offering more consumers more competitive choice. But others strongly dissented, saying the FCC decision disrupts the balance between the state and the federal government. Unfortunately for the commission, all the lipstick in the world can't disguise this pig, said Commissioner Ajit Pai. He questioned whether FCC even had the authority to rule on the matter, since it's North Carolina and Tennessee regulations that are at play. You can't say you're for competition, but deny local elected officials the right to offer competitive choices, said Chairman Tom Wheeler, adding that localities' authority had been undermined by state-imposed red tape. What we're doing today is cutting away that red tape, consistent with Congress's instruction. Institutional investors line up for Square One Bank proceeds. A planned buyout of Durham-based Square One Bank by Los Angeles-based commercial banker PacWest Bankshares could prove lucrative to some longtime investors. The deal values Square One at $27.49 per share, less than its February 27 close of $27.68 per share. But for institutional investors, it's profit potential. Square One, which made its NASDAQ debut last year, raking in about $56 million in its IPO, announced March 2 it was being acquired by PacWest, causing an immediate stock dip. Square One shares closed down nearly 6% the day of the announcement. As is typical with these transactions, lawyers filed their first investigations into the deal as the shares fell, with securities law firm Andrews and Springer among the first to look into, quote, potential breach of fiduciary duty claims, unquote, against Square One's board, citing the share value price. Patriot Financial, an investment firm out of Philadelphia, could be the big winner, as it owned nearly 22% of the company prior to its public debut, or 4.5 million shares. The company owned 3.5 million shares as of February 27, worth $96 million in the deal. Square One was founded in 2005 and is based in Durham. It has 13 offices across the country, including branches in California, where PacWest already operates. It wasn't immediately clear whether any branches would close once the deal is finalized, but Durham would lose another headquarters. Square One typically funds loans to venture-backed companies from their first investments through post-IPO or acquisition, such as a $7.5 million loan to newly public Heat Biologics last year. Allegiant Air adds nonstop RDU service. New Florida flights begin in May. Raleigh-Durham International Airport's newest carrier, Allegiant Air, is readying for takeoff. The niche airline, based in Las Vegas, announced February 24 it would be offering nonstop flights from RDU to Punta Gorda, Orlando, and St. Pete Clearwater in Florida starting in May. The firm plans to contract with the U.S. Ground Service for the flights. According to spokesman Justin Raylencotter, Allegiant, quote, is focused on serving the leisure traveler in untapped or underserved markets, and we anticipate there being a lot of demand for ultra-low-cost vacation travel from the Raleigh-Durham market, unquote. The airline currently serves Asheville Regional Airport, Concord Regional Airport, and Piedmont Triad International Airport, providing cheap flights where add-ons such as carry-on bags cost extra. And in a section headlined SaaS, Goodnight holds rank on Forbes' billionaire list. SaaS CEO Jim Goodnight continues his tenure as the richest man in North Carolina, according to Forbes magazine. In its 2015 ranking of the world's billionaires, Goodnight, listed as being worth $7.5 billion, ranks 177th. And finally, in a section called By the Numbers, and this is related to the article concerning Square One Bank. Square One's biggest shareholders as of February 27, 3.5 million shares, Patriot Financial Manager LP, 2.2 million shares, Basswood Capital Management, 1.9 million shares, Endicott Management, 1.9 million shares, Castle Creek Capital, and 1.4 million shares, North Haven Management. And now moving on to the page of reporter Jason DeBrun, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. The main headline, How to Build a Better Clinical Trial. Durham Nonprofit Offers New Path. Josh Summer wants to increase the odds of matching a drug to a disease, specifically to chordoma. It's widely known that therapies approved for some diseases can work just as effectively when targeted at other diseases, but matching those therapies with diseases can be like throwing darts in the dark. So drug companies don't often invest in speculative trials. However, showing that a drug can be effective in a disease model is an important step to justify investment in clinical trials, especially for rarer diseases. Summer, co-founder and executive director of the Chordoma Foundation, wants to help. It is currently difficult for companies to access preclinical models of chordoma and other rare cancers. Scientists use these disease models for early-stage research to see how a particular compound or protein might affect a disease. To help get drugs tested against these chordoma models, the foundation contracts for in vitro and in vivo screening services and acquired cell lines and patient-derived xenograft mouse models for chordoma research. Summer now approaches drug companies, asking them to test their products against chordoma, and offers them an easy way to run those tests. We are trying to minimize the difficulty and cost of evaluating drugs in preclinical models, Summer says. Our aim is to generate evidence that would provide rationale for a well-justified clinical trial that is less likely to fail. If it works, the drug companies can pursue more trials and possibly seek approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to sell their products to treat chordoma. If the preclinical tests, meaning those not performed in humans, show no efficacy in treating chordoma, then the drug company just walks away with no losses. But Summer and the foundation at least got another test out of the deal, and one of these tests could ultimately lead to a cure. There has been a shift from being reactive to proactive, says Summer. To be sure, the foundation doesn't simply offer a free test to any and all takers. Still, its systematic approach to finding a higher likelihood of a match is wide enough to allow for some serendipity. In 2013, the foundation took in $1.6 million in grants and donations, more than double its 2012 receipts, according to tax filings published on GuideStar. GSK Novartis $25 billion asset swap closes. The $25 billion deal in which GlaxoSmithKline and Novartis swapped major assets closed this week. Originally announced April 22, 2014, the transaction includes GSK's acquisition of Novartis' vaccines business, excluding influenza vaccines, the creation of a consumer healthcare joint venture between GSK and Novartis, and the divestment to Novartis of GSK's marketed oncology portfolio, related research and development activities, and rights to two pipeline AKT inhibitors. This now makes GSK the number one producer of vaccines. And finally, in a question and answer interview headlined Triangle Life Sciences, Robbie Huffines joined J.P. Morgan Chase & Company in 1991 and is a vice chairman of investment banking. He was a presenter at the 2015 CED Life Sciences Conference, March 3 through 4. How do venture capitalists in today's environment think about drug development, and how does the Research Triangle Park area stack up? There has still been a reasonable amount of investment in drug development, particularly in oncology and rare or orphan diseases. That's driven by the number of successful recent IPOs. The U.S. has attracted a lot of the investment dollars. The Research Triangle is one of the strongest areas for innovation within the United States. Boston has been particularly successful recently. The Triangle is a positive, but the company's specifics drive the investment, not the region. The year 2014 was a one for life sciences public offerings. Do you see a shift away from small drug startups partnering with big pharma? There is still a healthy market for partnerships and licensing deals, particularly for smaller companies that want the distribution networks and experience of bigger companies. But we are seeing more smaller companies able to go the IPO route because they can enter the market with a smaller sales force than might be needed for, say, cardiovascular maintenance or diabetes drugs. After years of massive mergers, the recent trend seems for big pharma to become more specialized and focused on core areas. How will this affect drug development? There has been sporadic consolidation, but you could also make the case that the pharma industry is still fragmented. So more consolidation is inevitable. We also have seen several specialty pharma and biotech companies get large enough to become factors The reality now, however, is that a lot of larger companies are working hard to change their portfolio, sharpen their focus, and are no longer trying to address all therapeutic areas. In that environment, we may see some asset swaps, and we will see deep investment in new treatments and therapies. And now we move to the A Better World page, and we start with the column written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, Why Donor Cultivation Matters. In the spring of 2007, at the invitation of First Citizens Bank, Beth Boney Jenkins of the North Carolina Community Foundation met in Raleigh with a group of the bank's trust officers to talk about how the foundation could work with them as they advise clients on their charitable giving. Outreach to professional advisors is one of the key dynamics of our work, says Jenkins, the foundation's vice president of development. They are very often working with people of wealth or people with charitable interests who would be in a position to utilize the services of the foundation. That meeting ultimately led to a $20 million endowment from the estate of a Wilmington philanthropist, represented by one of the bank's trust officers. The fruit of relationships that Jenkins developed over 7 years with the trust officer and the donor. In August 2007, Jenkins got a phone call inviting her to meet in Wilmington with the trust officer, her 90-year-old client, and the client's lawyer. By establishing a donor-advised fund at the North Carolina Community Foundation, Jenkins said at the meeting, the donor could avoid the initial and ongoing expense of a broad range of tasks needed to create and operate a private foundation. After the meeting, Jenkins was asked to draft a document creating a donor-advised fund. And in January 2008, she met again with the donor and her two advisors in Wilmington, where the donor signed documents creating the Louise Oriel Burevich Endowment. The initial amount donated to the fund was modest, Jenkins says. The idea was after she started the small fund, she would sort of take us for a test drive and determine whether this charitable vehicle was a fit for her ultimate estate gift, Jenkins says. Over the next 7 years, Jenkins visited the donor at least 3 times per year, and for the initial meetings, always meeting both with the donor and the trust officer. She also talked every 3 months with the trust officer. The visits with the donor, each lasting an hour or two, were social, Jenkins says. In her final years, working closely with her professional advisors and the foundation, Jenkins says, it was Burevich's clear intent to create the donor-advised fund and leave the bulk of her estate to endow it. Twice a widow, Burevich had no children. On September 20, 2014, Jenkins received a phone call from the trust officer who said Burevich died that day. She was 97. She left $20 million, the bulk of her estate, to the fund she created at the foundation. The foundation will create a committee to administer a grants program to support causes Burevich cared about, including women and children, animals, and education. You have to build a relationship of trust, especially when donors are thinking about their legacy giving, Jenkins says, referring to significant gifts donors make through estate planning or bequests. You find out what's important to that donor, and you listen. And in nonprofit news, Merck and Premier team up to volunteer. Merck and Premier Incorporated held a volunteer throwdown to see which firm could log more volunteer hours during the last 2 months of 2014. The companies collectively volunteered more than 5,000 hours. In the Research Triangle area, charitable organizations included Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina, Ronald McDonald House of Durham, Habitat for Humanity International, Durham Rescue Mission, Historic Stagville Foundation, and Opportunities Industrialization of Wilson. Merck, a global pharmaceutical company, has a major presence in the Triangle. Based in Charlotte, Premier is a healthcare improvement company. Combined, these organizations represent a North Carolina workforce of nearly 4,000 employees. Students learn to invest responsibly. Business students at the UNC Chapel Hill will be investing real money using socially responsible principles. A $250,000 public equity fund will be managed by MBA and undergraduate students at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School. This social impact fund is a wonderful intersection of areas for which UNC Kenan Flagler has a long track record of excellence, investment, management, sustainability, and real-life learning, says Carol He, director of the Center for Sustainable Enterprise at UNC Kenan Flagler. And now we turn to the business profile in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal, and the profile is of Lookout Capital. Lookout Capital has 10 employees, assets under management, $16 million. The managing director is Merritt Moore. Founders, Merritt Moore and Bill Moore. It was founded in 2010 and opened in 2011. And the headline on this profile, goal, bigger deals, fewer checks, why Lookout Capital is pursuing a new investment model. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. The conference room is lined in lighthouses. They're on the bookshelves. They're painted in frames. The kids did that, said Managing Director Merritt Moore. They look out over investment meetings, pitch presentations, and interviews so that there can be no question you're at an investment firm, Lookout Capital. Feet away from the likes of Southern Capital Ventures, hidden behind Glenwood Avenue, Lookout Capital is a quiet and relatively new financial entity, having made its big debut in 2011 when it opened its doors, led by Bill Moore and his son, Merritt. Partners called it an invitation-only group of investors. Members pay an annual fee for the right to invest on a deal-by-deal basis. And deals have happened quickly, with the likes of Raleigh Workshop and Wright Foods among them, but the terms are changing. From its inception, the firm targeted North Carolina companies with annual revenue of between $1 million and $5 million. The stakes are about to get higher. Lookout's investors, according to Merritt Moore, all mentions here of Moore refer to him, are tired of writing small checks and they're strained by the pace. It caused us to rethink on both the Lookout team and the investor model, Moore says. We went out to investors and asked, hey, what do you really want to see as far as deal flow? Moore cobbled together a plan from their responses, one that calls for bigger checks and later stage deals. They're deals where we could have a greater ownership of the company and most of the time have control of the company or outright ownership, Moore says. While the pace will be slower, the firm has averaged about one investment per quarter, a pretty furious pace for our model because we have to go to all of our investors, Merritt says. The participation could increase. They'd much rather write one big check than write a bunch of small ones, Moore says. Moore and team have reshuffled the management, and they're about to start writing larger checks. While some bigger deals have been had, namely an $8 million infusion last March into Aseptia, which does business as Wright Foods, it's about to become the status quo, driven by that shuffled management team. Sam Drew, who was involved in investor relations, left the company. Operators Walt Clark and John Kane took on full-time roles with other companies but still participate. In their stead, former Waste Zero and Zerium CFO Michael O'Donnell and IT entrepreneur Robert Williams have taken operating partner roles. The firm has yet to close on a deal under its new model, but it's actively looking. Part of the process is selling its revamp, says Williams. We're telling the new story of what Lookout is seeking, and we're starting to see some deals pop up, Williams says. It's a lengthy due diligence process, and most of the time it begins through an introduction by one of Lookout's 70 investors. Generally speaking, the firm is looking at all verticals with the exclusion of real estate and life sciences. Under the new criteria, Lookout is targeting firms with revenue between $5 million and $25 million in North Carolina and surrounding states. Our vast preference is to do things as local as possible, Moore says. The firm will do deals outside of the area, but only if the entrepreneur brings the business to North Carolina, where Moore and team can keep an eye on their operations. Moore, just the type of straight talker needed to wrangle dozens of investors, didn't start with Lookout, Previously, he was a partner at Idea Fund Partners, an advising consultant at Rex Health Ventures, and even a branch manager at Wachovia. But the stakes are higher at Lookout Capital, especially now with more money. If you're going to write a bigger check, you have more pressure to do good work on the front end, Moore says. Investors, they remember the failures a lot more than the successes, so the magnitude, it matters. But in a sense, it doesn't matter. Because regardless of whether it's $10,000 they lose or $100,000 they'll be calling. So let's just do our diligence, he says. And now we turn to the viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal and the guest column that's written by Catherine Arrowood, who is the 120th president of the North Carolina Bar Association. The headline, North Carolina Court System in Need of a Thorough Audit. We recently witnessed both the best and the worst of our judicial system. Through the persistence of the Innocence Inquiry Commission, evidence was located that freed two Robeson County men after 30 years of wrongful imprisonment. Clearly, a terrible mistake was made. At the same time, this case demonstrates the integrity of our system of justice in North Carolina. Few states admit their errors in this way. Whether a life or money or a child is in jeopardy, our court system must operate fairly, efficiently, and independently. Our system needs a thorough look and possibly an overhaul, and there could not be a better time to do this work. We are in increasing danger of losing the functionality of this branch of government. In 1966, in a major reorganization, our judicial branch began operating a unified statewide system that eliminated the piecemeal systems that had grown up over the previous decades. This unified system provided a level playing field for citizens in all counties to seek resolution of disputes. Since 1966, our state has enjoyed extraordinary but uneven growth. Citizens are not distributed equally across the state, and legal problems and issues have become more specialized over time. In response, we have created a variety of specialty courts, including family courts and business courts. These courts have proven valuable and worthwhile in our increasingly complex economy, but they are not geographically accessible to all of our citizens. At the same time, each county, regardless of population or need, continues to have the same basic non-specialty court structure. Compounding this problem is year after year of court funding cuts. According to the State Office of Management and Budget, North Carolina enjoyed population growth of 17.3% between April 2000 and 2009, and it continues to grow. Geographically, it is also a very large state covering nearly 49,000 square miles. More people mean more divorces, child custody fights, debt collection actions, probates, criminal proceedings, and appeals. Simply put, while our population has been increasing by double digits, and the technology and tools available to better serve a large and widespread population have been improving, we've cut spending on our courts from 3% of our state budget to 2.2%. No wonder too many of our court personnel work extra jobs to make ends meet. No wonder we have been unable to implement a statewide electronic filing and case management system. No wonder we have insufficient money to conduct jury trials and pay court reporters. Now is the time to do something about this. Some people have the view that our elected representatives believe that lawyers are bad, judges are even worse, and by definition, the judicial branch is being operated wastefully and poorly. We beg to differ. Since the November election, the North Carolina Bar Association has been fully engaged in communicating with our legislative leadership about these problems. We are pleased to report that in most quarters, the problems originating from continued court funding cuts are acknowledged. Responding to the recent calls to restore funding will not fix everything, however. The problem deserves closer scrutiny. We must create a single joint legislative and court study commission composed of folks from a variety of backgrounds to undertake an in-depth examination of how we are delivering justice in North Carolina. As we did in 1966, we must make decisions about changes in structure and funding that are data and fact-driven. Our county-by-county system is no longer workable in a state where our urban and rural areas have such disparate resources. Implementing truly efficient solutions is highly likely to require that court officials, most of whom are elected, accept that some positions will be abolished and consolidated. A more regional approach may be needed. This will present a great political challenge. We are confident that our state can take on this challenge. While we undertake this study, we must restore court funding in the next budget year. We must first address court personnel hiring and pay issues, then we can begin to address electronic filing and technology issues. Doing these two things will send the right signal to our citizens, as well as businesses and individuals considering relocation to our state, while we move forward with a more long-term and in-depth analysis of how we are delivering justice. Moving our courts forward is good for our citizens, good for business, and good for our economy. And in our remaining minute, we'll read as much as we can of the Spotlight in the People on the Move section. This is of Michael Woodward, head of operations at Bull City Learning. Having spent the last 4 years as the operations chief for the Pharmaceutical Institute, the training subsidiary of Campbell Alliance, Michael Woodward has now been tapped as head of operations for Bull City Learning. In his new post, Woodward focuses on all things delivery, and he works to do what he calls match the right team and the right resources to each project to develop the best digital learning products possible for Bull City Learning's clients. Founded in 2013, Durham-based Bull City Learning is a digital learning agency. The firm consults in the area of learning strategy and works to create compelling, media-rich learning experiences that can be delivered in any digital format to any device. BCL employs 7 staffers in the Triangle, plus 9 digital delivery contractors situated across the country and abroad. What is the one thing you wish people knew about your job? The view from my office is like no other. Looking out, it's enthralling to meet the needs of modern learners across a sea of industries. We support an athletic shoe retail chain, an environmental waste consultant, biopharmaceutical companies, and global health agencies. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.